high-paid nursing, drug screens for kids, and lowering cholesterol, plus a look at insecticide poisonings. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. Man, we've got a great show lined up for you. I'm very excited. We have Lisa Booz from Maryland Poison Control Center visiting us with another update of her Tox Tidbit segments for us, as well as all of the news and commentary that goes along with the show. So I really want to urge you to stick around and listen to the rest of the show, and also head over to The Nursing Show website at nursingshow.com. Once you're over there, you'll find links to everything we talk about in the show notes for this podcast, as well as all of the other podcast show notes pages, and also articles, news items, and links to interesting stories related to nursing that I post up from time to time throughout the course of each week. Plus, you can also find the form to sign up for the Nursing Show newsletter, a great way for you to get all of the links from each week's show emailed directly to you in your email inbox. And once that's squared away, you'll be able to find out exactly when each show is posted and also have a resource to follow up on all of the news items and informational links that I put into each show. So a great way to do that is with the newsletter, and you'll find that form over at the Nursing Show website as well. I look forward to having all of you stop by and visit us at nursingshow.com. Busy week for me. If you're listening to this on Friday the 15th when the show is posted, I am actually currently in Las Vegas, Nevada for the New Media Expo, the podcaster's convention of choice for the year, and I'll be there learning about what's new in podcasting as well as speaking on using podcasting in higher education. I was asked to speak at this year's Expo, and I'm very happy to do so. And so I'll be talking with educators and podcasters at one of the sessions there about how I use podcasting as a tool to educate both people that need continuing education and for first-time learners like nursing students, and also for the EMT and paramedic learners that I have listening to the MedicCast podcast over at MedicCast.com. And so that's where I am this weekend, and I'll be back home following up next week. Time to jump on in and look at this week's nursing news. And the first story in the news really leapt off the screen when I found it in my search for nursing news this week, and I thought it would be one that I would share with you. How do you think your pay scale fits in with other nurses and other professions in your area? I know none of us are in it for the money. We're nurses because we really like to take care of people. But, you know, the pay isn't bad, and in some cases, as this article will show, the pay is even better than not bad. In Illinois, a recent survey of salaries of state employees conducted by the Chicago Sun-Times found that a suburban Chicago night shift nurse is earning more than the Illinois governor and the state Supreme Court justices, making her among the highest paid public employees in that state. Now, Hold on to your chairs, sit down, steady yourself for a second here, because this nurse is making more than $201,000 a year. That's right, I said $201,000. It's tripling her base salary using overtime and shift differential at a developmental center near Chicago, and she is ranked 7th on the list of the state's highest paid employees and office holders. And number one is the Chicago police superintendent, who makes around $300,000 a year. But boy, I'll tell you what, $201,000 for this nurse is not too shabby when you think about it. I bet that's something that a lot of student nurses out there don't even dream of when they think about what the pay scale might be for nurses. Now, I know this is an unusual case, and that's why it caught my eye, but I just have to think, wow, it's clearly this shocked the reporter that was doing the study, and clearly I think it shocked me a little bit too. But certainly showing that nurses are certainly appreciated in some areas with a salary commensurate, at least according to some, with their experience and training. Okay, enough talking about money. Let's talk about some patient care issues. A study from the UC San Diego Medical School has looked at lowering cholesterol, and these researchers are proposing a broad change in the way that we approach lowering cholesterol. They think that we are doing, as they say, quote, too little, too late. And I think that I agree with this, but they're going to be shaking some things up in their approach to this because they are talking about lowering cholesterol and fat intake as early as infancy and adjusting and moving dietary and lifestyle changes far earlier in a person's lifespan than trying to play catch up at 40, 50, 60 years old when a person has already begun to experience side effects from ongoing cardiovascular disease. Now, we all know that cardiovascular disease and heart disease are the leading causes of death in this country and in generally in many parts of the world. So this seems to make a lot of sense, but it is going to require a broad sweeping change in how we approach healthcare with our patients. We need to be much more proactive. Certainly, there have been many concerns about the childhood obesity epidemic that is ongoing as a problem in the United States. And I think that clearly this is part of that initiative, getting kids to have more exercise, encouraging them to make better and more healthy choices when they are choosing food items on their own, changing the way school lunch programs are structured so that children are not getting so much high fat and high cholesterol foods in their school lunch programs. There are a lot of different ways from a public health standpoint that this can be approached, as well as from a person's private health practitioner viewpoint. And certainly as nurses, we are on the front lines of encouraging and assisting patients to learn how to make those healthy choices and to direct them to the appropriate interventions and referrals as necessary to dietary services, to physical and occupational therapy, and to exercise therapy, really encouraging people. I talked, I think, last week in that show about the fact that people who actually had a direct intervention in developing an exercise plan were much more successful in lowering their weight and beginning a healthy exercise lifestyle than people who were just lectured about the healthy benefits of exercise and actually giving someone a schedule to fill out and helping them to say, we're going to exercise 20 minutes 3 days a week, and we're going to fill it in on the schedule, and we'll meet back in a month. Having a definite plan and a follow-up program has been shown to be much more successful. And I think that similar types of direct interventions are going to be necessary to make changes in people's lifestyles. Because let's face it, who's feeding these kids? Their parents are. If their parents aren't eating a healthy diet, their children are not going to be eating a healthy diet. If the parents aren't interested in exercise, the children will not grow up to be interested in exercise or be interested in exercise as a child. There's only so much that can be done if the intervention isn't looking holistically at the whole person and indeed their place in the whole family. So I think this is a great initiative, and I look forward to finding out exactly how they can structure a low-fat diet so that it is safe for children, because children need different nutrient programs than adults do, and their dietary requirements are different. But I think this is a step in the right direction. Finally, I want to close out with a story about children and emergency department visits. And this is based on a story I found over at WebMD.com that talks about a recent article in the journal Pediatrics from a study by researchers at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. They looked at about 600 pediatric patients under the age of 2 coming into the emergency room at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh between March 97 and July 2006 with signs and symptoms of an ALTI event, that apparent life-threatening event. sudden case of apnea or periods of seizures, things like that, that parents are frightened and bring their children into the ER or call 911 and have them transported to the ER. And when they looked at this study, they found that a significant number of them tested positive for cough and cold medicines when a tox screen was run. And the findings of this study and the conclusions by these researchers is that anytime a child comes into the ER with an ALTI event, the apparent life-threatening event, they need to have a tox screen run as a matter of course because of the fact that the parents may have given them adult doses of medications not intended for children. Now, we all know the FDA has pulled the general cough and cold medications off of the market for infants and toddlers under the age of two. These over-the-counter decongestants, expectorants, antihistamines, cough suppressants are all responsible for numerous serious life-threatening events, including death in children. And so the FDA pulled them in 2007 from the market and basically said they weren't available. But that doesn't mean that the parents don't have them in the house with adult doses. And they may be administering these, trying to guesstimate a safe dose for their young child. And in fact, there is no such thing as a safe dose in these children. And so the child may be experiencing severe side effects of these medications. And I think you can hearken back to when Lisa Booz talked about the dextromethorphan overdose issues faced by some people and in fact, also children in the previous episode of Tox Tidbits, oh, I guess about a month or maybe 2 months ago. So something to think about and something to be aware of when if you're working in the emergency department or if you are working for a pediatrician's office and have a patient with that is brought in presenting with some unusual side effects, you might want to remember this article and encourage a routine tox screen, just in case the child may have been dosed with medications not intended for children. This week, we're going to be having another interview segment with Lisa Booz from Maryland Poison Control, and I wonder what Lisa has for us today. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, with another segment of Tox Tidbits with Lisa Booz from Maryland Poison Control, and I can't wait to find out what Lisa's got for us this month. Hi, Lisa, how you doing?
Hi, Jamie, I'm doing fine.
What do you have for us this month?
Well, this month, we're going to talk about some insecticides. Whether listeners are in cities, suburbs, or rural areas, they may find themselves confronted with a possible insecticide poisoning. And there are a lot of different types of insecticides. I mean, there's so many different types of insecticides, it's really difficult to keep track of what's in which products as well as what the toxicity is. They're found in homes, they're found in workplaces, on farms. So it's important to have a basic understanding of the toxicity of the insecticides. A little background, little numbers for you. In 2006, there were nearly 69,000 exposures to insecticides that were reported to poison centers. Typically, patients will present following unintentional or suicidal ingestions, or they could be overexposed when in a residence that was recently sprayed, so more of an inhalation type of exposure, or there could be a dermal exposure to the products while they're being used, or there may even be contamination of food with insecticides. That occasionally happens as well. Now, the most common insecticide product for household use contains pyrethrins, a substance called pyrethrins, and related substances. Now, those chemicals are found in your more common products like Raid and other brand name products that we've all used at some point in time, and you can find in pretty much any home. Pyrethrins are derived from the chrysanthemum plant, and fortunately, they have very low toxicity, and usually what we see are maybe some rashes or some mild allergic reactions when people are exposed to those products, and not much more than that, so they are pretty safe. Other products contain chemicals that we classify as chlorinated hydrocarbons. They're also known as organochlorines. It's another term for those types of chemicals. Most of these chlorinated hydrocarbons have been banned from at least residential use, if not altogether, because they're so toxic and they do present an environmental hazard. But the most common chlorinated hydrocarbon that's available to the public today is a substance called lindane, and that's used topically for lice. These insecticides are neurotoxic. They lower the seizure threshold, and they produce central nervous system stimulation. Excessive exposure to these insecticides, such as maybe a case where someone has improperly used a lindane product or overused it on their child, that will result in tremors, agitation, seizures, and even death. The organophosphates and carbamates are the two classes of insecticides that most commonly cause toxicity in humans. There are more than 18,000 products that are licensed for use in the United States, and more than 4,000 exposures to these insecticides were reported to poison centers in 2006. So, again, a pretty large number of insecticides exposures with these two particular types. And these are the ones that we really are concerned about the most in some respects. The organophosphates include substances like diazinon, malathion, parathion, and there are multiple other ones that fall into that class. Common carbamate insecticides include aldecarb and one called carbaryl, and some of the listeners might be more familiar with the brand name for carbaryl, which is called 7. Both types of those insecticides bind to a substance called acetylcholinesterase, and that's the enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine in the body. This causes an excess of acetylcholine, and that results in a type of symptom or a group of symptoms called cholinergic symptoms. Now, some of the listeners also might be familiar with these cholinergic signs and symptoms by remembering a mnemonic, and one of the most common ones is called sludge. And the S stands for salivation, L for lacrimation, U for urination, D for defecation, G for GI symptoms, and E for emesis. Along with that, we see some signs and symptoms that we call the killer bees, B for bronchorrhea, bronchospasm, and bradycardia. Others out there might be familiar with another mnemonic called dumbbells to remember those symptoms. The D is for diarrhea and diaphoresis, U for urination, M for meiosis or constricted pupils, B for bronchorrhea, bronchospasm, and bradycardia, E for emesis, L for lacrimation, and S for salivation. I think probably most of your listeners have been exposed to either one of these mnemonics at some point
definitely.
In time in their training.
And actually, I think that we don't think of it as always insecticide poisoning because lately, with all of the anti-terrorism focus of some of our training, we hear a lot about these substances as potential agents to be used in a chemical attack.
That's right. Yeah, nerve agents. Which we definitely are concerned about when we talk about terrorism, do produce the exact same signs and symptoms. They're almost exactly like the organophosphates. And so you will see these sludge and these dumbbell types of signs and symptoms with the nerve agents.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we'll never see that, but again, it's a good way to remember it. Now, the excess acetylcholine that's produced also attaches to receptors called nicotinic receptors, and they produce quite different signs and symptoms. And what you see are more neuromuscular signs and symptoms. You see tremors, muscle weakness, muscle paralysis, for example. The activation of that receptor will sometimes produce tachycardia and dilated pupils instead of the bradycardia and constricted pupils that you would expect due to these cholinergic symptoms. So sometimes it's kind of unclear what you're going to see in the way of the heart rate or what the pupils are going to look like. Now, a third mechanism of toxicity is that the organophosphates also cross into the brain, and so they can cause seizures, respiratory depression, and lethargy just from this central effect, this direct effect in the brain. There are two main differences between the organophosphates and the carbamates. First, carbamates don't really cross very easily into the central nervous system. So in most cases, the CNS effects are not as common or as severe with the carbamates. Secondly, organophosphates undergo a process called aging. Now, aging is when the enzyme inactivation becomes permanent. The time to aging really depends on the specific insecticide. So it can vary from insecticide to insecticide. Carbamates don't undergo aging, and so the effects that you see with exposures to the carbamates are usually shorter in duration, and they are reversible, where the organophosphates are sometimes irreversible. Now, when we talk about treatment, First, it's very important to identify the product involved, take the product, the label, or a list of the ingredients, whatever you have access to the hospital with the patient. Different organophosphates have different onsets of action and aging times. Some insecticides are more toxic than others, so knowing which one is involved will really help the clinician predict the patient's clinical course, the prognosis, and the length of treatment. I highly recommend involving the poison center early on to help with identifying the insecticide, because that's often very difficult to do because they're long chemical names. It's very hard to tell sometimes whether that chemical name is really an organophosphate or a pyrethrin or, you know, what class that falls in. And will also help to assess the poisoning and also provide some treatment recommendations. As always, the ABCs are important considerations. Intubation might be necessary in severe cases. Rapid and complete decontamination is a very important part of the initial care of the poison patient. And the decontamination must be done very carefully but completely prior to transporting the patient to the emergency department. There have been numerous cases of first responders and emergency department personnel becoming toxic because they've been exposed to the patient that has not been decontaminated, or they've been exposed to the clothes or body fluids from the patient that contained the insecticide. Don't save the patient's clothes, just throw it out. You know, clothing has to be disposed of. Activated charcoal may be useful for ingestions if it's soon after the ingestion, if the patient is awake and alert, and if there are no other contraindications to the activated charcoal. There are two antidotes for organophosphates and carbamates. The first is atropine. Atropine is an acetylcholine antagonist that reverses those cholinergic or sludge type of clinical effects. It's usually given IV. It's usually given in a dose of 2 to 4 milligrams for adults and 0.05 milligrams per kilogram for children, with a minimum dose of 0.1 milligram every 5 to 10 minutes. And the end point is when the pulmonary secretions dry up and the person is breathing easier because of the lack of secretions. Extremely large amounts of atropine may be required. We've had patients that have required even hundreds of milligrams of atropine. And sometimes they need atropine infusions for days, you know, not just a few hours, not for a day, for many days. Once you've reached sort of a critical point of atropine where they start to develop some adverse effects from the atropine doses, they may become confused, they may become hyperthermic, they may have flushing, they may have tachycardia and also dilated pupils. The second antidote is pralidoxime, otherwise known as 2-PAM, and that's given in healthcare facilities for the organophosphate poisonings in conjunction with atropine. It actually reactivates that enzyme, that acetylcholinesterase enzyme, if it's given early, and it has to be given before that aging process occurs, and it will reverse the musculoskeletal effects, so the muscle weakness and the muscle paralysis. So using pralidoxime or 2-PAM is really vital to maintain the function of the muscles that are involved in respiration. Pralidoxime is usually not needed for carbamate poisonings. We don't usually have to worry about giving it for the carbamate poisonings or overdoses because the enzyme inactivation spontaneously reactivates. So it's just generally not needed. 1 to 2 grams of pralidoxime is given IV to adults, and then that can be repeated in an hour if symptoms aren't relieved, and then every 3 to 8 hours is needed. The pediatric dose is 20 to 40 milligrams per kilogram up to about 2 grams maximum per dose. It's sometimes given as an IV infusion instead of boluses in the hospital. It's just the preference of the clinician. Even after symptoms have resolved, patients need to be observed for a recurrence of the organophosphate toxicity, and that has occurred up to 3 to 4 days after the initial symptoms have resolved. So they do need to be admitted and observed for a number of days to make sure that they don't develop those symptoms again. Some EMS providers actually have what's called a Mark I nerve agent auto-injector. You know, we mentioned the fact that the nerve agents are very much like the organophosphate.
Uh-huh.
So we have these auto-injectors available now for nerve agent exposures, and they contain single-unit doses of the atropine and the pralidoxime. The last thing I just want to mention is that you need to keep in mind that there may be other toxic ingredients in these products. For example, there are often solvents like kerosene or other types of hydrocarbons that present a risk of aspiration pneumonitis. They also may produce some CNS or central nervous system effects when inhaled. So again, it's important to consult with the Poison Center so that we can also help to identify maybe other toxicities, other ingredients that produce toxicity, and we'll help you with determining what treatment might be needed for those other ingredients. So, given a patient, you're treating a patient that with a possible insecticide exposure, again, decontamination, supportive care, and sometimes anecdotal treatment is warranted, and call the Poison Center. And again, our number, I like to remind everyone of our number, it's 1-800-222-1222, and that will connect you with the local Poison Center wherever you are in the United States.
Lisa, that's just a fantastic wealth of information there, and I don't think anybody realizes how much goes into the single topic area of insecticide overdose or accidental exposures, but there's really a lot to keep in mind there, not the least of which is remember you have access to the resources of the Poison Control Center. So I want to thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank Lisa Booz from Maryland Poison Control for stopping by and sharing her expertise with us yet again. You can find more information and even get her email newsletter over at mdpoison.com for the Maryland Poison Control Center. And also find out more about all poison control issues via the links on that website. A great resource for you. I also want to remind you all to make sure you head over to nursingshow.com for follow-ups and links to everything talked about in this podcast. Also, make sure you get in touch with me with any comments, suggestions, or even corrections about anything that I've discussed on today's show. You can reach me by email at comments@nursingshow.com. I'd love to hear from any and all of you. That's it for me. I'm going to close out the show, as I always do, with some PodSafe music. Since we talked about insecticides with Lisa this week, I found a song by a group called The Detonators, and their song is called Bugs. So check it out. I will be back again next week with more shows for you. In the meantime, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and remember, folks, stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Signs. When a cop pulled me over, he asked me, was I blind? I got bugs on my window. You know I can't see. Somebody get me some blue stuff. Wash these windows for me. Sights, driving all day and half of the night.